Sounds True presents The Lost Mode of Prayer, Session 1, with Greg Braden.
This body of information that we'll share together is entitled The Lost Mode of Prayer. The reason I've chosen that title specifically is to share with you a possibility. It's an ancient possibility, a message of hope that I believe is particularly relevant to this time in our history and in our memories. Immediately, I'd like to talk about prayer. Prayer is something very deep, very personal for every individual. And over the years, for as many individuals as I've spoken with, I've probably had that number of responses in terms of what prayer means to these people. Prayer means something a little different to everyone. So I'd like to say right now that any idea, any mode, any practice of prayer that you have ever participated in your lifetime, that prayer has served you. So please hear me. I'm not saying that any form of prayer is wrong or that it's bad or that there's anything wrong with using that mode of prayer. What I am suggesting is that there is a mode of prayer that was lost to the West a long time ago. And that mode of prayer makes even more complete and more empowering our memory of our relationship to one another in our world, and particularly at this time in history. I'll invite you to allow for the possibility that within you lives the ancient memory of a highly sophisticated vibratory technology that we call prayer. So we'll share together, we'll explore the possibilities of this lost mode of prayer. Why was it lost in the first place? Where did that occur? What does it mean to us today? If we had this information, how would our world be different? Well, to develop this body of information, I'd like to share with you a couple of stories. And the way I'll share them is I'll begin them now and we'll finish them at a later time when we have all the information to make sense out of the stories. I'd like to share with you a couple of mysteries that I've witnessed recently in my life. They're mysteries for which modern Western science makes no allowance. These are mysteries in terms of what we would expect to see in our world today within the context and the framework of what our science, our physics, and our chemistry allow for. In ancient traditions, however, and indigenous traditions still living today, what we often view as miracles are common and expected within their frame of reference because their belief systems allow for it. Their belief systems say, of course, as we interact with our world, the creative forces of the cosmos and one another, of course we would expect these results. And in our Western world, in the last 1,700 years, we have developed a sense of being separate from the creative forces of the cosmos, and in that separateness, perhaps we've forgotten our miracles. Well, the first story that I'd like to share, for some people, has been one of the most moving, although one of the briefest bodies of information that I've had to share. I recently witnessed a video recording that was taken from a medicineless hospital in China, where they practice on a daily basis what today we could consider a mode of prayer. They may not call it prayer as such, and it embodies all of the tenets of the prayer that we will share together today. This video is so empowering because it allows us to see with our own eyes in real time the great possibilities of our relationship with the creative forces of our world. The video begins in a practitioner's room where a woman is lying on a gurney. She's the patient. She has a 3-inch diameter cancerous tumor in her bladder. And there's a computer and a CRT screen up on a desk. And on this CRT screen, we're seeing an ultrasound readout, just like we do in the West today for unborn children. so that we can see the fetus in the mother's womb. The ultrasound is being shown on the left-hand side of this computer screen. So they scan the woman's tumor, they show the ultrasound image on the left side, and they freeze that frame onto the screen for a reference. Now, on the right-hand side of the screen, they begin to scan real-time so that we can watch this tumor respond to a mode of prayer and can compare it to the left-hand side and see what's happening. There are three practitioners that are standing around the woman's body. The woman is fully awake, fully conscious. She is not anesthetized. She is a willing participant in this process, and that's key. She trusts, she believes in the process that's about to unfold within her body. And she's allowing for those around her to participate in the process. What the three practitioners begin to do, as they close their eyes, they go through a silent process that I'll share with you as we go through our work. And the only visible sign of anything happening that we see is a phrase that's being spoken among them as they reinforce one another. And the phrase simply says, wasa, 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 wasa. And loosely translated, it means already done, already accomplished, already healed. In their frame of mind, they're saying that this woman is already healed, and that's their belief. What begins to happen? In 2 minutes and 30 seconds, real time, on the screen, we watch the ultrasound image. The first few seconds, it appears nothing is happening. Suddenly, the tumor begins to quiver, and then it almost melts as it breaks down. It melts and falls away with such completeness that even the lining of the inside of the bladder has no scar tissue left to even indicate where this tumor had been. And it happens in 2 minutes, 30 seconds. And when it's over, the practitioners look up, they politely bow, clap their hands, and say, next. They're ready for the next patient because to them, this is a commonplace occurrence. When I share this video with individuals in our country, people are in awe. They say, this is a miracle. Everyone has to see this. How did they do that? My question is, what is it in our paradigm, our science today, that doesn't allow for this kind of healing? What happened between those three practitioners? What happened between them and the woman on the gurney? What happened to that 3-inch diameter tumor in 2 minutes and 30 seconds? Why did it disappear? What is the mechanism? And we'll answer that in just a little while as we go through this scenario. The second story I'd like to share with you is a scenario that I witnessed personally in 1995. I had just completed a conference on the West Coast, and I was meeting conference colleagues for dinner. It was in the evening. I was walking toward the restaurant where we had agreed to meet through a dark parking lot. And I could see people in the lobby moving around, and I noticed an elderly gentleman and his wife coming through the crowd out the door. And he caught my eye because he was moving differently. He had a walker that preceded every step, and every step I could see was an effort for him. So he'd place a stainless steel walker in front of him, and he'd shuffle his next step, and then they'd do it again and again. He and his wife left the lounge, the restaurant lobby, and they stepped onto the sidewalk. Apparently, they had not seen the drop-off from the sidewalk down to the curb, down to the street level. It's about a 6-inch drop. And as his walker was placed on the ground looking for that next solid foothold, he missed. And he went into the street, and I watched. It was almost in slow motion. I saw the walker precede him, and then a crumpled heap. He fell on top of it, still clutching onto the hands because he trusted his walker so much. And there he was lying on the street, and his wife knelt down beside him. And by that time, I saw what was happening, and I rushed over. And although I believed I was the only one that saw this, by the time I got there, someone else was already there. And I had not seen this woman. I don't know where she came from. I hadn't seen her out of the corner of my eye. And I didn't see how she got there so quickly. She was already there. She examined this man carefully. He was fully awake, fully conscious, a little dazed. There was a mercury vapor street light that was above us. Those are the lights that you see along the freeways in the United States at night, very odd lights, and they distort colors a lot. So we were looking at all of this scenario underneath this street light. And I watched this woman, and she carefully took this man's head. She cradled it in her arms, in her lap. And there was a little trickle of blood that was coming down somewhere the back of his neck onto his shirt. And without saying a word, she meticulously traced this path of blood, the little zigzag line, and she carefully parted the folds of skin in his neck to find out which one was the source of this injury. And she found one fold as she separated it, and there was a darkened gash just below his ear on the back of his head. In the mercury vapor light, it didn't even look red. It just looked dark. It was almost colorless. Without saying a word, she took two fingers of her right hand and simply began to stroke the area where the tear had occurred in his skin. And in just a couple of minutes, in the presence of the crowd that had gathered to watch this, we saw the tear disappear in 2 minutes. Well, by that time, someone had called the paramedics. They arrived, the ambulance pulled up, the sirens were on, the lights were flashing. They came rushing over. She gently handed the man's head, it was still cradled in her lap and her arms, over to the paramedic. She stepped back, and the paramedic went through the same process. He saw the blood in the shirt. He traced the trickle back to what should have been the source of the wound, and he looked up at the crowd in amazement, and he said, "Where is this blood coming from? We can't find anything. There was no wound there." It had healed so completely within such a brief period of time, just a couple of minutes, and we looked around and the woman was gone. Now, I did find out later who she was, and I have spoken with her about this. My question is, what happened in that moment? Why was that healing so rapid? Why was it so complete? What is it in our Western science that calls that a miracle? What have we forgotten to allow for in our world? Well, as we explore together the possibilities of the lost mode of prayer, once again, I'll invite you to allow for the possibility that prayer transcends Western science the way that we see it today. This mode of prayer transcends religion. I'll invite you to allow for the possibility that prayer has nothing to do with religion, and religions were built around specific modes of prayer. That prayer is a highly sophisticated vibratory technology that we embody in the cells of our being. And as we have the wisdom to collect and redirect the power within ourselves, then these miracles come to pass. Maybe they become less than miracles. Maybe they become a way of life in our world. Well, prayer clearly transcends simply healing our physical body. We are offered in ancient traditions, ancient texts, and we hear modern accounts of prayer influencing the events of our external world as well. And this is one of the reasons I'm choosing to share this lost mode of prayer at this time. I've been chastised in recent months through some officials who have known of this mode of prayer for a long, long time and say there was a reason it was taken out of our text 1,700 years ago and we're not ready for this mode of prayer. And what I say to them is that if we're not ready now, then when will we be ready? Here we are at this crucial window of opportunity that the ancients called the shift of the ages, when all of the parameters of time are converging on this moment in history. Ancient calendars, ancient texts, almost universally, the traditions of those who have come before us, the oral traditions as well as the written traditions, they point to this time in history. They say that this is a rare moment. This is an opportunity. It's a window that has opened up to us to redefine who we are in this world and to carry that new definition of who we believe we are across the membrane of time and space and experience, across the moment that the ancients called the shift of the ages, now that we recognize as the birth of a new millennium. We're reminded through so many ancient texts and traditions that this millennium that we are closing out has been a very unique experience. It's been an opportunity for the people of this world to experience the parameters of hate and fear and rage and anger. On the one hand, while on the other hand, being given the tools to transcend fear and hate and rage and anger. And it's that transcendence that we're invited to carry across the bridge between all that's ever been and that which is yet to be into the new millennium, laying the foundation, building the building blocks for all that is yet to be. If not now, if we are unprepared at this moment in history to empower ourselves with this inner technology now, then when would we ever be ready for it? I believe this is the time, and I believe that we are prepared to embrace and allow for the possibility of this ancient wisdom that lives within our bodies. Now, there is a particular reason why I'm sharing this now. There is a great mystery in the traditions of those who have come before us. Almost universally, the calendars and the texts and the prophecies point to this time in history. Some of them are so clear. They have identified all of the previous cycles leading to this time. The Aztec calendar, for example, identifies four previous worlds before this world. They say there were four worlds. We're living in the fifth world. It's about to close, and we're moving into the sixth world. They were so clear. They identify how they ended. There was a great world that ended during the time of giants on this earth, giant animals as well as people who essentially devoured one another, is what the story says. Now, through some of the new texts being discovered in the Aramaic translations, they lend credence to that story. There is a world that ended in fire before our world. There was a world that ended in ice before our world. There was a world that ended in a great flood before our world, and that great flood is what many speculate may be the biblical floods. They were so clear, they identified these worlds and the characteristics, and as they look at the world now that we're about to close, not one of the prophecies, not one of the predictions, not one of these ancient traditions goes so far as to say how our time completes, how this world ends. They lay out possibilities, and they offer scenarios leading up to the great change of this time in history, and not one of them goes so far as to describe what this world looks like as we move through and complete this great time that now is being identified as the zero-point experience, or the shift of the ages, or the close of the millennium. And there's a reason for this, and the reason is because these ancient traditions identify a variable in the equation of human experience and human evolution. They identify a variable that is still being defined. And that variable is described as the way the people of this time in history respond to the great challenges of their lives individually. Those individual responses provide the collective wisdom that determines how we evolve. It determines what comes of this time in history. It determines the scenario. It's still being determined in this moment. Now, there's a common thread that runs through many of these ancient traditions. And that common thread is that in the viewpoints of those who have come before us, they see great periods of catastrophe, catastrophic destruction, tremendous loss of life at this time in history. That has been shared for so long. Many people are expecting to see that now. And what I'm offering today is the possibility that that scenario is simply that. It is one possibility. And we have a very good body of evidence now suggesting that there is another possibility that may come to fruition through our choices in terms of the way we live our lives, the way we live our worlds. Modern scientists, research physicists, now suspect that time and the relationship between experiences has a much different characteristic than we've ever believed in the past. They suggest the possibility that in any one moment in time, several possibilities are occurring simultaneously. In any one moment in time. Some people call these the theories of parallel universes. Now, it sounds a little abstract, it sounds a little esoteric, and it becomes important, and I'll share with you why I believe this is so key. Because scientists also believe now, research within just the last 4 or 5 years has demonstrated that the choices we make in our lives, day in and day out, what we feel are the insignificant choices, how we respond to the wait person that brings our food to us at lunch, and how we address one another day in and day out in our lives, those little insignificant experiences, that's us demonstrating our mastery each day in life, individually. Collectively, our mastery determines which reality we tune to, just like a television station. So what I believe has happened is that in these ancient traditions, as brilliant, masterful prophets and seers looked from their time ahead and even beyond our time, and they saw these possibilities of destruction, they were looking through the corridor that was aligned with human mastery on a global level at that point in history. And it's a very real possibility. And what we also know now is that the seers saw other possibilities that are much more beautiful and transcend destruction and the loss of life. They offer a great ray of hope and possibility, and those visions were taken out of our texts 1,700 years ago. 1,700 years ago, we began losing the possibilities of joy, and we were only reminded of the possibilities of destruction for this time in history. And I think most people pretty much agree, as we have the opportunity to travel this country, United States, and also my wife and I travel throughout the world. And we ask people, how do you feel about this time in history, and what do you expect to see happen? And there's a dichotomy, because on the one hand, many people feel very positive, and they're excited about the possibilities of what this time means. And on the other hand, they say, our prophecies and our predictions say this is a time of great destruction. Well, what I'd like to share with you as we go into this work in more detail, some of the prophets, and some of them are ancient prophets, some of them are very recent prophets. Perhaps one of the oldest prophecies for this time in history is found in a very mystical book of our Western Bible. It's a book entitled Revelation. And as you'll see in just a few moments, the revelation that we have today is essentially a Reader's Digest condensed version of a much broader Aramaic text that includes the messages of hope and possibility as well as the messages of doom and destruction. And you'll understand why the translation changed, why it was condensed. The prophet John is the author of the book of Revelation. And John shares through the Aramaic traditions that in a dream, he asked to see what would come of the people of this world. And in a dream, he was taken from his time ahead of our time and shown all the great possibilities of war machines and destruction. And he describes them with such detail that it's hard to imagine that he could have simply made them up in pre-biblical times, because they so accurately describe the war machines and the destruction that we've seen today. He was shown a book that had 7 chapters, 7 seals, and as he touched each chapter open before him, he witnessed the possibility where the people of this world, of this time, had turned their backs on the forces of nature, where we had turned our backs on what they call the angel of the air, the angel of the wind, the angel of the earth, where we had harnessed power and used it for destruction instead of production. And John was heartbroken when he saw this. He was in tears, and he fell to his knees before those who were showing him this. And he said, is this the only possibility? Is this all that we have to look forward to? John said, I would do anything. I'm only one man, and I would do anything to change this. And this is the way he describes. He says, the angels of the world. And if you don't like the word angels, you can simply call them electromagnetic forces. Call them a formless consciousness that came and whisked John away into this scenario. The angels looked at him, and there was sadness as well as joy in their eyes. And they said, John, this is only one possibility, and all it takes is one man, one human, to choose life and to live that life fully, and this scenario will never come about. And John says, I'll do that. I'll be the one. I'll be the one to do that. And the angels looked and said to him, You who are at once the highest of the high, the lightest of the light, and the lowest of the low, and the darkest of the dark, you're both of those together. It's for you that heaven and earth were created so that you may know yourself and love on a level deeper than any angels have ever loved before. And John goes on to share a possibility that I'll describe in more detail that was taken from our text 1,700 years ago. So that's, when we talk about prophecies, that's one of the most ancient. A little more recent, there was a 16th century prophet many of us know today as Nostradamus. And one of the most amazing things about Nostradamus is that his texts have been continuously in print since the 16th century. They have never gone out of print. Over 300 years. Now, his books have been continuously in print. What a record for an author to be able to boast of. I mean, how great. Books have been around for 300 years. Nostradamus' prophecies are a little nebulous at best because he writes in terms of what are called quatrains, and they're very poetic. So there's been a lot of controversy about them. One of his best-known works is called The Centuries, because there are 100 quatrains describing the centuries. And what scholars do agree upon is when they've backed in the dates into the scenarios that he's talking about, 1988 appears to be the beginning for Nostradamus of a window in time that extends into our time, 1988, a window in time where we may expect to begin seeing these great cataclysmic changes in our world. More recently, a prophet of Edgar Cayce, I know many people are familiar with the works of Edgar Cayce, was known as the sleeping prophet because he would essentially go into a trance as he shared his information. And although he came about it from many different perspectives, some of Cayce's prophecies were so precise in their languaging. For example, he predicted that 1998 would be the beginning. It would open the window of a period of time where Earth would see such great change, geographic change, that we would never recognize our Earth again, as well as change within our bodies. He went so far as to predict a shift in the rotational axis of the Earth, as well as reversals of the polar magnetic field, 180-degree reversals of the magnetic field. Now, our scientists have gone back in the geologic record, and we know there's a precedent for this. Earth's magnetic fields have flipped 180 degrees. What used to be north became south, and what used to be south became north. Earth has seen that at least 14 times in the last 4.5 million years. We've seen that happen. We've never seen it happen with 6 billion or so people living on the planet. So we don't know precisely what that means to us. And even more recent prophets, such as Gordon Michael Scallion, some of you are familiar, I know, with his newsletters and his work and the maps of the world that he's created, describing what he sees. And I believe that, Gordon Michael Scallion is a heartfelt being that is sharing to the best of his ability the visions that he's seeing in a given moment and doing his best in the only way that he knows how in that moment to share that with people so that they may prepare themselves, possibly averting some of these experiences. Gordon Michael Scallion sees great geophysical changes, the great inland sea that we saw during the Cretaceous period of Earth 300 million years ago, 350 million years ago. In his visions, he sees that once again as the Great Lakes are connected with the Gulf of Mexico. And it's interesting because the satellite photographs from the floods of 1993, when the Mississippi and the Missouri rivers were out of their banks for weeks on end, they appeared very similar to some of those old maps of Earth, as well as some of Gordon Michael Scallion's maps. And the seismic activity, global volcanic activity and earthquake activity. All these prophecies are pointing to a period of catastrophic change and destruction. My belief, and I'll share this with you, I am an optimist. It's important for me to say that. I see this window of time as a great window of hope and possibility rather than a window of doom and destruction. What I see and what I've witnessed, having researched many ancient texts, many ancient traditions, including our own Native American, almost universally, if we look closely, the predictions and the prophecies are very clear. They remind us that the destruction is simply one path, and that this unknown element, this variable that's still being worked out, human consciousness, how we treat one another day in and day out in our lives, and what we feel are these insignificant moments in the presence of one another, those are the keys. That's the science that allows us to determine the outcome to this time in history, that allows us to build the foundation for our future. And in that science, the tenets of compassion, forgiveness, peace within our bodies, peace between one another, and peace on a global level play a key role. And we're reminded that peace occurs between individuals before it ever happens between governments and nations. They left us a technology. They left us the keys that allow us to create that peace and once again to commune with the creative forces of our world. So as we're moving into this body of information, the reason I am so passionate about this now, that I'm sharing this now, is because if we're ever to embrace the greatest possibilities of what it means to be human, if we're ever to allow for our greatest potential to be expressed in life, this time in history, at the shift of the ages, the close of the millennium, the zero-point moment, this is the time to call back to us, to reclaim the inner gifts of technology that have always been our heritage, and to create what we choose to create from this point forward, to become peace, forgiveness, and compassion in our world now, because that is what we carry across as the living bridge into this time that we call the new millennium. It's the great possibility of this time in history. Once again, as we look into the traditions of those who have come before us, we find that the ancient calendars and the verbal records, as well as the written records, almost universally, they pinpoint with tremendous accuracy this time in history. The Mayan calendar has been the source of tremendous study in recent years. The Mayan calendar, by some accounts, began over 18,000 years ago. It identifies these tremendous expanses, vast cycles of time, and the Mayan calendar ends in July of 1992. The Mayans said in July of 1992, time as you know it stops, and that there is a window of time, a 20-year period between 1992 and December of 2012, they called no time, and it's during that time that there is a final reshuffling. It's a reorganization of patterns of energy that determine what happens from that point forward. And I often share the story. I have to laugh each time I think about it. I had the opportunity to meet a Mayan holy man a few years ago, and I asked him what I felt was a very simple question. I said, if your ancestors had the wisdom and the insight and this tremendous technology, the systems of timekeeping, and you were so accurate, why don't we have a calendar from 1992 forward? Why don't we have a new system of timekeeping? And he laughed at me. He laughed at me when I asked him that question. He said, don't even try to build a new calendar because time will never seem the same to you again. You'll never perceive time the same again, and your body will never perceive time the same again. We clock time with our bodies biologically as well as with our logic. And he said, both of those are changing at this time in history. By the way, the Mayan traditions, in their accuracy, they predicted that the people of the earth, the cycles of the earth, would go into a period of darkness 500 years ago. And in terms of the Mayan traditions, we emerged from that darkness in May of 1996. May of 1996. So if some of you are listening to this and you feel that just within the last few years something has shifted and something has changed, it may account as the Mayan calendars were tied to solar and planetary and lunar cycles. And we know that each of our stars and our planets have vibratory patterns influencing the way we live in our world. Something changed. Something converged at that point in history. And the Mayan traditions were not the only one. Perhaps one of the most interesting and one of the traditions that has been kept secret in tribal circles for so long was the prophecy of the Hopi. There is a rock in northern Arizona called Prophecy Rock outside the village of Oribe. And this rock has a very simple, very eloquent map to guide the people of peace. The name Hopi means people of peace, to guide them through several hundred years of tribulation to this time in history, and the image on the rock simply begins as two parallel paths running horizontal to the ground. Two parallel paths. One of the parallel paths, the one on top, eventually begins to curve upward with jagged lines, and it ends in a thundercloud with lightning and rain. The path on the bottom is a straight path and ends in a field of corn. Corn stalks are growing. Well, about two-thirds of the way from the left of these paths, two-thirds of the way over, moving to the right, there is a line that connects the two paths. And what the Hopi say is that these paths represent the possibilities that all humans of Earth may choose in their lives. One of the paths, the one on top, is the path of comfort, greed, and profit. And when I asked about this, profit particularly, it wasn't profit in terms of money. It was the profiting, us excelling in our lives at the expense of another. Okay, it's that kind of profit. If you have to walk over someone else to get where you're going, you've profited by someone else's pain. And that's the profit they were speaking of. So the upper path is the path of comfort, greed, and profit. The lower path is the path of love, wisdom, and compassion. Now, the upper path, very interesting, shows three humans standing side by side. They're drawn as stick figures. They have faces on the stick figures with hats on top of the faces, and each of the heads are separate from the bodies of the stick figures. So the head with the hat is shown, and then there's a space, and then the stick figure is drawn below. The people who walk the path of comfort, greed, and profit, their heads aren't attached to their bodies in this image. And that path leads, it looks like a pretty good path to begin with, and eventually it gets kind of rocky and it breaks up and leads to some stormy weather and nowhere. The lower path is a straight path, and it ends in this field of corn, and it shows people tending the corn at an advanced age. They have a cane in their hands, they're bent over the corn, and they're saying that the path of love, wisdom, and compassion is the path that carries us gracefully along our lives in the presence of all the challenges that life may offer. And the interesting thing is that two-thirds of the way over, along these two paths, moving from the left to the right, there's this line in between. And the Hopi prophecy says that every human has the opportunity to go back and forth between these two paths. And they look very similar at first. Some people can be deceived. They look very similar. And we may make the choice to go back and forth between these two up until a certain time in history. And from that point forward, the choices are made, and it's very, very difficult to choose once again. If one has chosen the path of comfort, greed, and profit, beyond that point, it becomes more difficult to move into another choice. The Hopi share this now, and they say that we're very, very near this crucial point in history where we must choose. And the choice isn't always a conscious choice. We wake up in the morning and say, today I choose comfort, greed, and profit, or love, wisdom, and compassion. We make the choice in every moment of every day of our lives in the presence of one another. In each moment, we're reminded that we either affirm or deny life in our bodies. We affirm or deny life in our world, the gift of life in this world. In every moment, the cumulative choices at the end of the day for an individual pool into the collective choices of many individuals of a world, and that determines the path that that world follows. Isn't that interesting? The Hopi are so very clear that each of our lives, the events that we sense are insignificant, are of great significance. All through the American desert southwest, Chaco Canyon, northern New Mexico, there is a rock with a similar prophecy talking about moving through this time in history, showing the beings of this time holding the great spiral of life, and that the life is abundant in terms of the animals, domesticated and wild animals, food. It goes on to show children being conceived and born. Life is abundant after this period in time. Before this period in time, there can be some rough times, some tribulation, great cosmological events in the sky that now our own research is beginning to bear out, that perhaps some of the phenomenon that we're seeing, the cosmological phenomenon, are actually part of this. Even the Tibetans, they measure the great cycles of time following what we call yugas, Y-U-G-A-S, great expanses of time. We're presently in the Kali, K-A-L-I, Kali Yuga. And whatever is to happen from this point forward is being created right now. They can't tell us what it is because it hasn't been created yet. And even further, they view this lifetime as the crucial lifetime where the foundation for the new is being developed right now. They say that the prayers of the people of this time and the choices that we make in our lives are actually dictating the foundation for that which is yet to be. And this brings to mind that it's such an awe-inspiring possibility. In so many of these prophecies and the predictions, both oral and written, and the indigenous stories tell of a time of ending, of a time of completion. And while that is true in one perspective, the optimist in me identified with the optimist in the Tibetans. And they said, and I believe, and I say as well, if it is the close of this great cycle, and if it's the end of the Kali Yuga, and if it is the close of the Mayan calendar, and if this is the last century and the last decade at the end of this millennium, then it must be the birth of something brand new. It's the beginning of a new decade, of a new millennium, of a new cycle that doesn't even have a name yet in terms of the yugas. It doesn't even have a name as yet. The Mayans didn't even know what to call it, and they predicted time accurately for 18,000 years. The ancient traditions in the Middle East, as we see through the Dead Sea Scrolls and the pre-Egyptian traditions, they were so clear of this time in history. They wrote entire texts, they wrote books, volumes to a generation that they sensed would be the last generation to mature before the close of this cycle. They said to themselves, there will be a generation birthed with such power inherent in their beings, and perhaps a power that they have forgotten. Perhaps the pain of this world has moved them to a place in their lives where they've forgotten the great power that lives within them. Well, this last generation would be a generation of such strength that the challenges of the world coming to the close would push the people of that time to the very edge of who they believe they are. It would push them to the boundaries of the way they've defined their lives and the presence of one another. There are times when they would actually push one another over that edge. And when we go over that edge, we find ourselves in a place where we've never been before sometimes. The ancients called it the dark night of the soul. Perhaps a time we lose everything that we've ever held dear. We lose the lives of loved ones. We lose our homes. We lose our jobs. We lose our direction and our focus in life. Maybe we even lose our belief system. The great challenges of life will push us to the edge, testing those belief systems, allowing us to lose everything that we hold dear. And in that moment, we find ourselves in the nakedness of us and our world and our lives and nothing else. Then we must reach inside of ourselves and find our greatest strengths, our deepest levels of love, our greatest expressions of compassion to survive. And the ancients were aware of that. They said this generation is such a powerful generation that they will be the generation to bridge this moment in time. This generation will bridge all that's ever been with that which is yet to be. They will live the time the Mayans called no time. They'll walk between the worlds of spirit and matter and light and dark and time and no time. What they become at the close of one cycle becomes the foundation for all the generations at the birth of the new cycle. And this one generation has the power to elicit that ancient memory from within their beings and to lay that foundation. And they'll do it in the world of polarity. The polarity of the lightest and the light and the darkest of the dark, all the things that both have joyed and pained them, it's from within that polarity that they will rise above the polarity while they still live in it choose to transcend the things that have hurt them the most, and those choices become the foundation for this new way of life. In their words, you are that generation. You are those who walk between the worlds. They even had a name for you. They called you, you who walk between the worlds. The choices that you're making this moment in your life that affirm or deny life in your body as an individual are part of a collective foundation that's being created in this moment. And that's exciting. I mean, that's very exciting. It opens up a vast array of new possibilities. And it's within this context that the ancient mode, the lost mode of prayer, becomes one of our greatest assets and also an expression of one of our greatest gifts in honoring one another and the creative forces of our world. When we talk about the predictions and the prophecies and the written texts, and so often we refer to the ancient and to the indigenous peoples of the world, I'm often asked about Christian traditions, and even the Christian traditions mark this time in history. They point to now. The traditions that we're speaking of now are derived from earlier traditions that are based in those communities that we call the Essenes, E-S-S-E-N-E-S. The Christian traditions focused on one aspect of the Essene traditions, and over time, through history, through translations, and through the filters of those who were doing this work, other aspects of the prophecies were left behind, and those are what we'll go into and explore today. So even in the Christian traditions, in the Christian mystery schools, they focus upon and point to this time in history, and rather than being a window of opportunity, in those traditions became known as a time of judgment, and it was a time that actually became feared by some people rather than embraced and welcomed. We'll go in and examine precisely why and how this is happening. Well, this is through one paradigm, one belief system, the prophecies, the predictions, and the texts themselves. We live now in the 20th century in the Western world in a very technical paradigm. We're looking at different modes of prophecy and prediction through what we call science. Now our own science is witnessing events. They're measuring the information. They're compiling data of phenomena that are unfolding in our world right now. Many researchers believe support the ancient prophecies. Our own scientists are witnessing, at very best, they're witnessing natural phenomena that are unprecedented in terms of anything we've ever seen in recorded human history. And the phenomenon certainly isn't limited to our Earth. It's coming from way beyond our Earth, in places certainly that some of us have never even expected to see. When we talk about the prophecies and the predictions, as different as some are in specifics, there are certain levels of detail where they agree in general. Nearly universally, the prophecies say that at this time in history, Earth is about to change. Something's happening to Earth. They remind us that our bodies are made of the elements of the earth. If earth changes, we must change to accommodate those shifts. They remind us that we are the union between this mysterious force that we know as spirit and the physical world of our bodies, made of the earth, that we know as matter. We are the union of those two. And that as we approach this time in history, how we perceive and how we interpret the changes determine how we experience the outcome. And the Hopi, I think, were very clear about this. They showed that there were these different paths. Some would perceive this time in fear. They would be afraid of the uncertainties. And in the uncertainness, they would lose their way and forget the path that they had come to follow. At the same time, there are others who would be very clear of themselves in this time in history and view the tribulations as an opportunity to demonstrate the greatest levels of mastery in giving birth to something brand new. All of them agree that our bodies will change as well as our earth. And this is a piece, I believe, that's been overlooked in many of the Western traditions. As individuals now witness the changes in our world, there was a belief for a period of time that we could simply build shelters in caves or in the ground during this time in history and hide from and shield ourselves from the changes. And when the great shifts were over, we would emerge and then go on with our lives. That no longer is the belief. Now, individuals that believed that years ago are also understanding that the changes are about more than out there in the world, that the changes are happening within their bodies at the same time, and this interchange is what we're asked to come to terms with. Well, the Essenes, and I'm referencing the Essenes heavily here, because their records are some of the least distorted and some of the clearest of all the ancient texts and the traditions. And they left us their perceptions, their viewpoints of what our lives may entail and how we may address the great challenges of lives through the texts such as those have become known as the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi Library, many of the Gnostic traditions that we see in the Coptic monasteries in Egypt and Jordan originate through the Aramaic language of the Essenes. Some of these texts go so far as to identify a series of tenets. And what I've done is I've gone across the spectrum of the translations of the lost books, of the libraries that have been found in various forms, and condensed very concisely now into a single work, four key tenets that were shown through their traditions that we have neglected in our traditions. The first tenet reminds us that we are unity by nature, that there may be many physical bodies walking this world. There's only one consciousness here. That one consciousness, the second tenet, the one consciousness reminds us that we are moving collectively toward this rare moment, this precious time in human history, where we redefine the parameters of our lives and our world. The third tenet reminds us that we've always had a technology. We now may call it very precisely an internal technology that allows us direct access to the creative forces of our world and of our bodies. We call that technology prayer. And the fourth tenet reminds us that there was a science developed early on, thousands of years old, some call it the most ancient science, of compassion. It's through compassion that we're able to transcend the great challenges of history and life with grace. Well, if we had this information, our lives, our technology, our society may have developed much differently than it has without. We have found ourselves now on a path for the last 1,700 years or so of asking ourselves to interpret the great changes in our world, the great challenges of our lives, without context, without a frame of reference. And it's brought us to the point where we are today. Look how well we've done in understanding what's happening in our world without this ancient frame of reference. Scientists that I've dealt with, and I've worked in the world of science and engineering, aerospace, earth sciences, and when you use the word prophecy to a scientist or ancient predictions, while they may be interested, it doesn't mean a lot to them intellectually. It's almost considered in some instances to be a fantasy or a dream or something make-believe. Well, our own scientists now are validating phenomenon that are referenced in ancient traditions. They're phenomena for which we have no point of reference. They go beyond the boundaries of our Earth. 1998, in the prophecies of Edgar Cayce and of Nostradamus, and certainly of more recent ones, Gordon Michael Scallion, we mentioned earlier, falls well within, and in some cases, 1998 defines the beginning of a window of time where we may see the greatest changes, the greatest challenges ever recorded, ever experienced in recorded human history. Well, early in 1998, in the spring of 1998, now our own scientists began to measure changes that do not fall within the paradigm and the predictions of what Western technology says should be happening. Late 1997, there was an event that occurred and it was not reported until early 1998. Astronomers and astrophysicists measured an explosion that occurred on the boundaries of our known universe. This is a long, long way from Earth. Science News, the little journal that comes out weekly, documented that this explosion that occurred was of such massive proportions, it was second only to the Big Bang. The Big Bang is the explosion that many theorists and physicists believe began the universe as we know it today. From the soup of the nothingness, there was this primal explosion, and we are living the consequences of the Big Bang today. Well, the explosion that occurred in late 1997 wasn't reported until April of 1998. They said was second only to that Big Bang. It's the most massive event, celestial event, ever documented in recorded human history. And if it was second only to the Big Bang, and the Big Bang created this universe that we know now, then they're asking the question, is this a new universe that was birthed? Okay, that was early in 1998. Now, researchers have reported at least 2,000 additional explosions of at least the same magnitude on the edges of our known creation. 2,000 of what originally was the most outrageous celestial phenomena we could have ever imagined. Does that mean that 2,000 new universes have been created? Something is happening out there on the fringes of our known universe. Some theorists speculate that this dimensional expression is breaking up and birthing something new, starting from the fringes on the way out. I invite you to scan the tech journals and go into the Journal of Medicine, go into the Earth Science Journals. Science News is an excellent source. Every 7 days, they come up with a survey of all the things that are happening in layperson's terms, covering the broad spectrum of many different sciences, from physics to earth science and space, mathematics. The point here is, when we share these phenomena with people in the small villages in Tibet and in the Andes Mountains in South America, along the Nile in Egypt and the villages there, their traditions not only allow for these kinds of changes, they predict that these things will happen and even more as Earth goes through this time in history. They expect this. They have a frame of reference. They have a context. We lost that context in the West. Why? When did it happen? How did it happen? Well, the next few minutes, what I'd like to do is share with you where those losses came from, what they may mean to us, and how our lives possibly could be different if we had them again today. 1,700 years ago, huge portions of our most ancient heritage were relegated to the esoteric traditions, the mystery schools, and the sacred orders of their time. This occurred in the year 325 AD. In the year 325 AD, Constantine put together a council, became known as the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. And during that time, this council recommended that the redundant, mystical, loosely organized body of information that we now know as our Western Bible, that body of information be made more concise. So the council sifted through all of this information, these many books and the texts. Some of them were not even bound. Some of them were just loose leaf collections on papyrus rolls. They discovered that some appeared so mystical that they didn't understand them, and they assumed that if they didn't, no one else in the future ever would, so they took them out. They assumed that some of the information was so empowering to the people of that time that it really didn't serve them, so they were removed. At least 25 books were taken from our biblical text. We'll explore these in just a few moments. By the recommendation of this council, additionally, 20 other supporting documents. Now, these weren't necessarily biblical texts. They were references that the biblical text would bring in every once in a while. So at least 45 books that I know of were taken from our history, and the ones that were left were rearranged and condensed into what we today call our Western biblical text. Among the books that were lost from our biblical texts, the Gospel of the Birth of Mary. What a fascinating book. Now it has been recovered. It has been translated and is available in Western texts now. The Gospel of the Birth of Mary shows a story of the mother of Jesus of Nazareth and her mother. It shows that Mary, Jesus' mother, her mother was 81 years old when she gave birth to Mary and that she'd been barren all of her life. And that both Mary's mother and Mary were schooled in the esoteric traditions of the Essenes, of which Jesus of Nazareth also became a master in the Essene traditions. The infancy of the life of Jesus. This is a fascinating book detailing a young prophet in the early years of his life coming to terms with the powers and the abilities that he's come into this world to explore. And what we're reminded of in this book is that every human comes into the world with these abilities and that we deny them and that we forget them early in our lives and live the consequences of that throughout life. The difference between us and Jesus at this time in his life was that he didn't forget. He was encouraged to develop and honor these abilities by parents who had been schooled in the traditions that supported these. The book of Nicodemus, the books of Barnabas, the letters of Herod and Pilate. For me, this is one of the most interesting, one of the most fascinating books that was taken out of our text because it gives a very different view of Pontius Pilate and King Herod at the time of the crucifixion. To paraphrase and to make a long story very short, essentially what these letters say, Pilate wrote to Herod immediately after the crucifixion and said, King Herod, I believe we just made a big mistake. Herod was trying to distance himself from the crucifixion. And he wrote back to Pilate and said, what do you mean, we? He said, I didn't make the choice to crucify this man. The state of Rome had no interest in his crucifixion. That was done on a local level. And it's a very human insight into what these men went through, realizing what they had done and the role that they were about to play in history. It's a fascinating book. We lost that 1,700 years ago. The infancy of Jesus, as we witness him coming to terms with his power, he appears much more human, and we can relate to that in our humanness. Rather than believing that this man came into this world fully aware of his powers and just began going out and working with him. The book of the visions of the prophets, there is an entire book of visions, it's called the Book of Visions, that is filled with prophetic visions of what this time in history, our time, and they refer to it as the close of the cycle. In those days, these things will come about, these things will be known. And these are just some of the actual biblical books. The supporting texts are just as fascinating. There were books representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Each of them had their own book, the book of Levi, the book of Daniel. The books of Adam and Eve, there was the first and the second book of Adam and Eve giving tremendous insight into the seeding of their bodies and their consciousness into this world at this time in history. That was taken out. Perhaps one of the most telling is a book that is known as The Secrets of the Prophet Enoch. This is actually the supporting document, The Secrets of Enoch. This is different than the modern-day Keys of Enoch many people refer to, although the Keys of Enoch reference specific passages, and those passages became triggers for the author of the Keys of Enoch. This book is not actually the Keys of Enoch. Enoch was a prophet before the time of Christ. He was taken from his time ahead of our time, had the opportunity to witness what would become the people of this world, taken back to his world, and he dictated to his son Methuselah so that this message would be preserved for all of history. And he saw very clearly that at this time in history, there would be a great change. And he identified the change. He said, for example, that the weather patterns would shift and the crops wouldn't grow in their seasons, that rains would cease in some parts of the world and become very great in other parts of the world. He also talks about the earth becoming inclined on her axis during this time in history. And it's something geologists have struggled with in the past, how the poles have shifted, the magnetic poles, whether or not the geographic poles have shifted as well. The Book of Enoch goes on to share many possibilities of our inner technology and the role that we play at this time in history. It's at this time in history that all the secrets of heaven are at last divulged to the children of the earth. Through those secrets, they make the choices in terms of how they will live their lives from this point forward. So these are just some examples of some of these lost supporting books that we have today. During the 12th century, the books that were left, now these are the ones that have been condensed and rearranged, they were then poorly translated into languages of the West, into English at that time, further confusing a mystery of our purpose, our possibility, and even our relationship to one another in our world. So at very best, the way we interpret our world, our potential role within this world is incomplete without these texts? Is it possible? I ask this question now. Is it possible that the very basis of the way we've built our society and culture, our science, technology, language, religion, even the way that we relate and love one another, is it possible it's all based in an incomplete body of information? If so, how would our lives be different if we had this information? The lost mode of prayer is part of this that was lost 1,700 years ago. The lost mode of prayer, elements of it are spread throughout the Aramaic translations of these texts. Of the tenets that are available to us through these lost texts, if we were to go through all, at least the 45 books that we're aware of, and hone all that information down into those four tenets, and I just shared those with you. The first one says there's only one of us here. We're unity by nature. The second one reminds us that that unity consciousness is moving collectively toward this rare moment in history. The third one reminds us that we have direct access to the creative forces of our world. And the last one suggests that the science of compassion may be the most ancient science that allows us to gracefully transcend the great challenges of our life with grace. Well, two of those tenets I'd like to develop further. One of those, it's the one that says there's only one of us here, that our consciousness is holographic in nature. The term hologram means different things to different people. Do we really understand the implications of what it means to live in a holographic consciousness? When I say the word hologram, what do I mean by that? Of the many definitions that we may choose for a hologram, perhaps one of the simplest and the most eloquent may be as follows, that a hologram is simply a pattern that is whole and complete unto itself, and at the same time, it's part of an even greater pattern that is whole and complete unto itself, while at the same time is part of an even greater pattern. Now, this pattern can be non-physical energy, or it can be very physical matter. The cells of your body are holographic in nature. One cell has all the information it needs to create another one of you. It is whole and complete unto itself, and it's part of an even greater pattern that you call your body. Okay, consciousness works this way. We are many expressions individualized of a unity consciousness. And what that means, and this is the beauty of the hologram, any place in the pattern of a hologram where you make one little change, that change is mirrored throughout the rest of the hologram. If you make one tiny change, it's mirrored throughout the rest of the hologram. Perhaps a good example, this is a story that's told from the Spanish journals when the explorers were coming over looking for new routes into this world in the 1500s. One of the routes took them around the coast of South America, and the Spanish galleons that were making this journey, sometimes journeys took many months, up to a year, they set ashore for supplies in a place where the Spanish had never recorded being before, and they were met on the shores by the indigenous people of that area who apparently had never seen white people before, had never seen Western technology before. And fortunately for this particular story, one of the first men to meet them on the shore was the shaman of the tribe. He was the holy man. So here the holy man of the tribe meets the Spanish as they're coming ashore. They left the large ships out on the water and they came ashore in smaller rowboats. And however they communicated, in whatever language they were using, the holy man asked them, "Where did you just come from? I mean, they've been here for years. They've never seen people like this coming up onto their shore." And however they communicated in return, the Spanish said, "We came on this little boat from that big boat with the wooden planks and the canvas sails out on the horizon of the ocean." And the holy man looked to where the Spanish were pointing, and he couldn't see that ship. The ship was there, and it was of a pattern that was so foreign to his frame of reference, it made no sense to his conscious recognition. He didn't recognize it. And as I hear this story, I often wonder, how many times does that happen in our world, in our lives? How many times do things happen right in front of us, And maybe we disallow it because it doesn't make sense in terms of our frame of reference. Is it possible there's a whole separate world going on here that we haven't recognized because we don't allow for it in our paradigm? Well, because this was a holy man, because he was a shaman, he was fascinated by the possibility that these people came from something that he couldn't see. So another individual may have dismissed it. The shaman worked with it. And eventually, what he said, in a matter of moments, he says, you know, if I look out of the corner of my eyes and I squint just the right way and redefine the shape of my eyeball, I begin to make something out on the horizon. And in just a few moments, he taught himself how to see a pattern of matter that he had never been exposed to before. He taught himself to see that. That happened to him on the shore. Miles away was his village, and the people in his village didn't have the same experience that he had, on the one hand. And within just a couple of days, on the other hand, they too benefited from his experience because they then were able to see what was happening on the shores. How did that happen? They weren't witnessing with him. On the one hand, the other hand, they learned through his experience. The term we use today is called collective resonance. And what it means to us is that every time one person chooses a new way to respond to the challenges of life, each time an individual chooses a new option, that person then becomes a living bridge for all the others who choose to follow in that person's path. It's not about imposing will on anyone. What it is about is that person now that chose a new way, that chose a new path, they have created a template of a new possibility very close to the consciousness of all others who choose to follow. And that template now becomes more accessible to the next and the next and the next. The shaman on the shore, he chose to see a new way, and through collective resonance, others benefited from his experience. This is the beauty of the hologram. If we have a pattern, perhaps it looks like a snowflake pattern, and that pattern is whole and complete unto itself and part of an even larger snowflake, which is whole and complete and part of an even larger snowflake. And there is one place in each of these patterns where there is a little pointed tip, and we take the tip off in one place of the snowflake. That tip no longer exists anywhere in the pattern. That's the beauty of the hologram. When a change occurs in one place, it's mirrored throughout the whole. It's mirrored throughout the rest of the system. What that means to us simply is this. Here we are on the threshold of a new millennium, creating a new paradigm, a new way to respond to the great challenges of life. We have lived in a world of polarity where we have hated and feared and judged and killed, and we've always had the tools to rise above that hate and the judgment and the fear and the killing. Each time one individual chooses a new way to respond, chooses something other than hate, chooses something other than retribution. That's a big one in our culture now. If you do something, you've got to get even. You've got to pay for what you've done. It's not right, wrong, good, or bad. It simply is a path, and there may be the possibility of a higher path. Each time one individual chooses that possibility, it makes it easier for the next and the next and the next. So we ask ourselves, are we choosing to carry across this bridge into the new millennium hate, judgment, warfare, and killing? Or do we choose peace, forgiveness, compassion, and love, honoring all of the polarity that brought us to this moment? The hate, the killing, the judgment, the anger, the warfare has served us. It served us well. It thrust us onto a path so we would know ourselves in that way. And now we're invited to heal that path and to choose something new rather than judging the path, being angry at that path, and moving on. That's the beauty of the holographic model of consciousness. That is why there's only one of us here. We're all going through that doorway together. No one is left behind. Everyone benefits from each choice that we make as we birth this new millennium. In the spring of 1998, my wife and I had the opportunity of leading a small group of people into the central mountains of Tibet, of the Tibetan Plateau. Of the many reasons we went into this journey, one of the reasons for me, the primary reasons, was my sense, my suspicion, that perhaps the great libraries house the written records, and that the monasteries of the monks and the nuns were preserving the traditions of a culture that preceded them, that of the ancient Essenes. We know best the traditions of the Essenes from their writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We know that they originated about 500 years before the birth of Christ, that they created communities suited to their lifestyle of honoring the great traditions and the esoteric teachings of our world. We also know that after the crucifixion, they dispersed into the world, that some of them went into the jungles and the mountains between Bolivia and Peru. Some of them came into North America and settled in the American desert southwest. Others, we're told, found their way into the Himalayan mountains in the Tibetan tradition. So my sense was that perhaps we would see those traditions preserved to this day. And if so, the value of this journey is as follows. Rather than speculating on what their prayers and their traditions meant from benign texts that we witnessed thousands of years later, we could actually interact with the people who were living the traditions. So we had a very heartfelt exchange among the peoples that we visited, and in that exchange, there was an honesty and an openness in the way they answered, and they began sharing with us about their prayers. And sure enough, what they affirmed through their traditions of prayer validated my sense of what I had seen referenced in some of the oldest texts of the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the Book of Enoch, for example, regarding this lost mode of prayer. In my training, and I was brought up in a relatively conservative Midwestern community where prayer was more about a time of either giving thanks or of asking that something come to pass. And those were kind of the modes of prayer that became my background. And as I journeyed out into the world as an adult and studied ancient traditions and cultures, what I found was that there were other modes of prayer that really weren't accounted for in the Western traditions. Western research today identifies four modes of prayer. They say that we use individually or in conjunction with one another. The reason I'm sharing that now is because in the mystery schools and in these Essene texts, it appeared that there was another mode that didn't fit into those categories, a fifth mode. And now, having recovered the texts through the Dead Sea Scrolls, now the Vatican vaults and the lost books of the Bible, and having correlated that and validated it through our conversations with the Tibetan monks and nuns, what we know is that there is, in fact, at least one additional mode, a lost mode, a fifth mode of prayer that allows us direct access to our bodies and the creative forces of our world.
This concludes Session 1 of The Lost Mode of Prayer with Greg Braden. Our program continues with Session 2.